Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
Another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it is a belated episode. We've been on a bit of an unofficial hiatus of sorts for the last few weeks, just because we haven't been playing a lot of new games lately due to the circumstances. Recently there was actually a sale on Steam for a tabletop simulator, so I acquired the game, and we've been playing a couple games online that we want to talk about in the future. But while we prepare for those episodes, we thought we'd hit you with a new episode this week discussing a game topic that Matthew and I have some thoughts on. So what are we talking about this week?
So today we are talking about player count, just sort of like why different games have player count and what player count means, how it's balanced, things like that. I think player count is something that can sometimes feel arbitrary, like, you know, why support four players and not five, or, you know, something like that.
Or why is the minimum three instead of two?
Yeah, and if you have a group that's larger than the max player count, it can feel bad, which is something that we ran into a lot growing up.
Sure. I mean, it still comes up every now and then, just, you know, depending on how much of a family shows up for an event, that will determine how many players we can have.
Yeah.
And while, it's always an odd number for us.
Yeah. And while like different rules of the game can be house ruled, player count is something that's very, very difficult to do house ruled style.
Oftentimes limited by the components of the game itself. So should we get into some details? I'll let you lead the discussion. So just let me know where you'd like to start and we'll go from there.
Right. So first, I just want to say I don't really have any notes for solo games, single player. Okay. I feel like those are kind of their own beast. And if we do cover them, it would probably be its own episode.
Sure.
Because they're designed and balanced way differently from multiplayer games.
Of course.
And I think, though it is worth noting that a lot of multiplayer games nowadays do have solo options, but they essentially have a computer player.
Right.
You know, think of the automata that Stonemaier Games has, that Leader Games put in Root. Stuff like
I think
that.
The only thing I would say is just that, yeah, either a game could include a automated second player, usually controlled by some amount of randomness, like a deck, or the game itself just has so much randomness to it that it's sort of like changes how the game is played every time you play it. There's no like competition to get in the way of because the randomness gets in the way of you.
Right.
But yes, we're specifically more interested in talking about multiplayer and what happens to a game when you add more players, and also what you have to do to a game to support certain amounts of players.
Right. So
okay.
I think the biggest thing is that when you look at large player counts, like 7+ or 6+, you tend to see those really only in party games, social games, or games with like simultaneous actions. So, like, the largest sort of gateway game is Seven Wonders, which can support 7 players, but you're doing all of your actions at the same time. Same thing with, like, Between Two Castles.
I think you can go ahead.
Yeah, so okay. I think the big thing is it's about pacing. You know, ideally, you want players to be engaged the whole time, and if a game has more, like, involved resource management, or you have to really plan out your turns, it can be a lot slower when you're waiting for more people before you can take your turn.
Sure.
Especially because the more players you add, the more the board changes between turns. So, like, you know, with 6 other players, you might not be able to plan ahead until 2 turns before yours. Just because it's so different.
So there's a couple things that are at play here that are being balanced so that a experience with large numbers of players, like 7 or more, is an enjoyable one. And so, like, the things that we're talking about here, first off, like you said, there's simultaneous play. But I think even if you're taking turns simultaneously, just because it's not like everyone can do their thing at once if there is some sort of main board that everyone is sharing. So you're also fiddling with like how much a player is actually doing on a turn. It's sort of like the scope of their actions. So a game with a lot of players, a player's action typically has a pretty narrow scope. So like in Seven Wonders, your action is pretty much just playing a card. Same with like a lot of party games, like Super Fight. Like you're pretty much just playing a card to do your action.
Right.
Or Charty Party. Yeah.
If you look at...
And so...
Yeah, if you look at a game like Citadels, that's a game where you still do take turns, but you are only doing like two actions and they're very quick actions.
Exactly. I think Citadels probably pushes player counts to their limit as far as like player actions and the amount of time each player spends, because that's a game where turns aren't taken simultaneously. It is one after the other. But yeah, like you said, the way that they balance that is by making the player actions very short. If players do have complicated actions, at least making a game so that they can take those complicated actions all at the same time is helpful. Another thing is just affecting like how much of the game one player does, or maybe another way of phrasing that is how many other players are affected by a player. So this also comes up in Seven Wonders and in Castles of the Mad, Between Two Castles rather, where a single player's actions only affect their neighbors. So if you're across the table from another player, you don't really have to pay attention to what they're doing and categorize and spend too much time thinking about it. So most of your time can just be spent looking to your left and to your right.
Right. Yeah. It's with high player counts, you kind of have to either have like a lot of mental bookkeeping. That's usually easier to do, I guess, to say when you have less physical bookkeeping. So like it's easier to manage mental things like what people like might have in their hand, hidden information like that, or what they've been doing when there's a lot less like mechanical things to interact with. So Citadels, like the buildings are pretty simple. They don't really do much so that you can keep track of what people are playing and drafting. But then that's also why social deduction games don't really tend to have a lot of like mechanical stuff going on. I mean, also it's that they don't need those to sell the game, but that you can, it's a lot easier to think of like, you know, who did they vote for last round, or, you know, what role did they say they were, when that's the only thing you need to keep track of.
You know, bringing up a social deduction game or a bluffing and deduction game actually raises a point that like the parts of the game, like the materials of the game, or like the components of the game, there we go, that's a good board gamey term, components, the components that a game uses can affect how long it takes for a player to take their turn. So like if you're playing with like little coins or little resource pieces, it can take a long time to fiddle with those to make sure you've got the right counts, in front of you. There's a lot of like just banking that you kind of have to do there, and math. Cards, slightly easier to manage because they're usually either in a hand or being played, and playing a card takes like very little time. Picking up a card and passing it to another player also takes very little time. But in social games, the component is conversation, and conversation is one of the like easiest things to manage in large quantities.
Yeah.
If the whole point, like look at Werewords, like seven people talking at the same time and the game still works.
Right. Yeah.
Same thing with bluffing and deduction. Like, it takes very little time for someone to say something and someone else to react to it. You know what I mean?
Right. And conversation is a good way to keep all players engaged.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of like a game doesn't need to always engage the player, but it wants to keep them moderately engaged,
mm-hmm.
Especially when it's like not their turn per se. And so, like, you know, for a lot of games, it's having strategic decisions they have to plan around, or having to plan ahead, or it's responding to what the opponents are doing. But when there's conversation as a central point, it's a lot easier for people to, like, tune into that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, helps with pacing, the idea that, like, you don't want it to be a crawl, you don't want players to be bored. And so finding a way to keep all players busy or interacting helps.
Mm-hmm. So in a similar vein, I think I'd like to eventually talk about games that allow you to prepare but not take your action yet. So like, for example, we just played Castles of Burgundy recently. And that game, each player takes their turn one at a time. Technically, this game has a limit of four players to it. Each player takes their turn one at a time. But there's an action that every player does at the same time at the start of the round just to sort of set up their resources for the turn. And even if you're not taking your turn, you can at least plan your turn out.
Right.
Now, depending on how much one player can affect the, you know, the public board state or the common board state for the other players, this can only go so far, because maybe if you have too many players, the board states change so much by the time it comes to the last player that all their planning didn't really matter. Not only is that frustrating, but also like that's time that they spent essentially unengaged. So there's a limit to that, but that's another way. If your players aren't going to be taking their turns at the same time, you should at least have some sort of method so that they can plan their turns. Like another example would be in Dominion, a player draws their new hand at the end of their turn and they have, you know, their opponent's turns to consider what they'll do.
Right. And then I guess the other like sort of simple way you can balance this is by having teams incorporated into the gameplay. So, like, Codenames is one where it has a pretty high, you know, reasonable player count, because it's really just two teams.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have as many players discussing things as you want on those two teams. And also that's another case where, like, the spy on one team can prepare and think about clues while the other team is talking. And the team that isn't being asked a clue at that time can still kind of consider either previous clues, or they can consider what the opponents might have.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but just having teams, that's sort of also what Between Two Castles does. You're still all making your own decisions, but it is in teamwork. So like strategizing becomes easier. And mm-hmm. so you can focus more on more things, I guess.
Sure. Codenames is another example of how conversation has a much higher limit than like any other mechanical component to a game.
Right. And then I do want to mention, we've touched on this a little bit, but components can be expensive. Mm-hmm. Especially things like plastic or wooden components. And so I think it's reasonable for games to limit their player count based on like MSRP and manufacturing cost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there are games that have player expansions that add new components, and those are pretty much, you know, to cover that extra cost. Like, you can buy Catan 5 and 6 player expansions that right. just add the board in pieces for 5 players. But it, you know, it costs more to make, so it costs more to buy.
So we talked a lot about what a game can do to support large numbers of players. But I guess my question is, when do you decide the upper limit, and why does that upper limit sometimes come to 4 or 5 players, other than material cost?
Right. So I think with social games, it's sort of you want to account for as many players as you can, because the sort of ideal landscape of a social game, the ideal environment, is to play it at like a party or a big group. So those either have just like a really high max number, like 15 or 12,
mm-hmm.
Or they have an unlimited amount. Like a lot of party games can technically support like 20 people if you really want.
Right. I think generally those games will just talk about a matter of teams rather than a matter of players.
Right. But so like as you start to go more and more into like, more strategic, like Euro style stuff, less party stuff at least. Mm-hmm. I think there are a few things to consider over like why you might want to cap it at a lower number. Obviously, there is the whole pacing issue and how many choices can be made that we've talked about already.
Mm-hmm.
That if
yeah,
you
there's there's a lot that you can do to like allow or allow players to take actions during other players' turns, or at least give them time to prep. But there comes a point where like a game designer has decided that they want their game to at least be a little bit, you know, involved strategy wise, and they want a player to have a good deal of agency for their turn, and therefore they can only cut down how long a player has to wait for their turn to come up so much. And so that might just be the upper limit, where six players is just way too long in between turns to expect someone to just sit there.
So I think another thing is, if you're designing like a strategy game, you typically design things like archetypes or paths, like builds, you know, strategies you can take. I feel like it's pretty common to do like the total number of blanket base strategies plus one or two players. So like Tapestry has four tracks on it, and then it's five players, which means that with four players, sure, like everybody could feasibly max out one track each. But with five players, it adds that competition to it that's pretty much forced at that point. So it's like the idea of, you want enough comfort that people can still specialize or whatever and not get too competitive over resources, but you still want some resource competition.
Mm-hmm. I think this definitely is takes a role in games with indirect resource competition. So Tapestry is one example. Lots of Euro games have indirect resource competition, worker placement games. Definitely the thing that you're balancing for isn't necessarily turn length, but more comfort in your strategy.
Yeah, like scarcity.
You want players to be brushing shoulders with one another, but still have a lane that they can carve out for themselves.
Right, yeah. Scarcity and like how likely you are to get your perfect build, quote unquote.
Sure. At least if maybe the game should be designed so that at least two players can go for the same strategy, and still find, you know, some success.
Right. I think it's...
I guess that comes a little bit more into balance rather than like player counts. But
right. Well, player counts are sort of a form of balance in this case. Sure. Yeah. I think it's also dependent on how difficult you want the game to be. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, there are games with huge resource scarcity, like Agricola. And adding extra players to Agricola adds a few extra resource spots, but not as many to still make it, like, easier, if that makes sense. Like, that's a game where adding player count doesn't change how scarce the resources are, and subtracting player count also doesn't change how scarce the resources are.
Bringing up this, I think that's one chance for us to segue into games that have modular boards or boards that have different modes depending on how many players are playing.
Right.
So for example, Viticulture limits the number of worker placement spaces depending on how many players are playing. Castles of Burgundy, that we mentioned earlier that we're going to do an episode on soon, it has different spaces that you use depending on how many players are playing. Yeah, I think lots of worker placement games do this, obviously, because there's, you know, the number of workers a player has, just adds more, more scarcity to where you can go. So you have to just add more space in most cases.
Yeah. And then there are games like Spirit Island that have, well, that's a cooperative game, but it still has modular boards for player count.
Yeah. The board really is literally modular in this case, where each player just has their own board that they add to the other boards.
Yeah. I think this is sort of a case where each individual player count can be a little tailored to what you want. So for example, like if you want the higher player counts to be a bit more frantic and like kind of take that E, you know, with a lot of backstabbing, you can make the higher player count board still sort of scarce or sort of small to force interaction. Whereas like for two players, you could make it small as well to encourage interaction, or because players won't need to cover as much space. But if you want to give players the option to play away from each other, you could also make the two-player board kind of big.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, as far as resources go, it's the same thing. It's a matter of, like, do you want resources to be hard to get? Do you want huge competition over them? Do you want it to be pretty safe? Like, is there a resource you're guaranteed to get? Terraforming Mars has the credits or whatever. And then those are a resource that you're always going to get, pretty much. And so every other... I guess you don't compete over resources in Terraforming Mars, but every other, building plants or raising temperature and oxygen and stuff, those can be competed over because players will have their own things they can still do.
Now, Terraforming Mars is an interesting game to examine because that's a pretty high-rated game, first of all. Just among other board gamers, but I'm pretty sure, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the temperature gauge, the oxygen gauge, and the ocean tiles don't scale based on the number of players, correct?
I don't think they do.
Is there anything in that game that scales based on the number of players?
I'm really not sure.
I don't think there is. And what this makes me realize is that one option that you have is, I mean, I think Terraforming Mars is, first of all, such a indirect competition kind of game, barring the disaster or whatever those cards are that lets you like specifically take one person's resources out. But there's a lot of indirect competition in Terraforming Mars. And the goal of the game is also not to like reach a certain threshold of points, but just to make as many points as you can. A lot of games have that as their goal. But because of this, like the more players, it just kind of changes how long the game takes to play, but in different ways. So like obviously more players means it's probably going to take longer time wise, but turn wise it'll probably be over shorter because the game ends when you run out of temperature advancement, oxygen advancement, and ocean tiles. It's like there's this limited supply, and once all of that supply is exhausted, the game's over. And if there's fewer, more players, then there's more people to take from that supply, which means that the game ends sooner turn-wise. But yeah, I don't know. That's interesting that the game doesn't really care about like how long it takes to play turn-wise. It just maybe changes how certain strategies might work. Or
it's similar to how like photosynthesis does it in other games where the timer is literally based on total turns played, where it happens to scale based on player count, because more players means fewer individual turns played per cycle, and less players means more individual turns played per cycle. So like you have more time to do your own things in this like shorter games, but you're also competing for space in the larger ones, which fits because you won't have enough space to do everything you could in the shorter games.
Sure. In these cases, the game doesn't do anything. It doesn't modify itself in any way to accommodate various numbers of players, but rather I guess the game has been balanced and designed and the player counts have been set so that the game isn't too unreasonably short or too unreasonably long. So like in Terraforming Mars, you know, maybe feasibly you could add, you know, however many, a fifth or sixth or seventh player, however its upper end is. But if you were to do that, players wouldn't get enough turns by the time that the temperature had risen and the oxygen had risen and the ocean tiles had been placed. And so that, because of that, that's where the limit stops.
Yeah. Let's see. So another thing about like balancing is there are games that balance based on how late you are in the turn order. So like... first player gets this many resources, second player gets this many, third gets this many, and so on. This sort of like gradual starting scaling, it's usually to help the person who's in last place because they, you know, are later along the game, sort of give them a bonus. But the more players you have, the harder it becomes to actually make each placement unique. So, like, for a six-player game, you might not want to make the fifth and sixth place have different amounts of resources they gain in this way, because then you would just have a huge resource imbalance compared to the turn order imbalance. So I think part of it is, like, you're kind of balancing around when people take their turn, not only in terms of how much time it takes to do so, but how you can balance those starting areas or, like, the difference between them. I think one thing about, like, Catan, for example, is with four players, it actually does, like, the sort of snake draft starting placement pretty well, where, like, you know, the first person gets the first pick, second person gets a pretty comfortable pick, third person is still kind of blocked in, but they get, you know, they're more recent. That sort of thing is harder to balance when there's more players as well, because the first person to pick in that sort of drafting order where it goes backwards at the end is a lot. It's like they have so much more time between their first and last picks.
Mm-hmm.
And then each sort of middle one between the first and last person to pick in the first sort of round is the difference between them gets sort of muddled a bit when you have too many players.
I feel like this point that we're making, where because if players are taking one turn after the other, then turn order and going first with more players has, like, an even bigger impact. But that counts, or that goes hand in hand with what a player does on their turn and how much a player can do and affect the other players on their turn. So in a game with, like, more simultaneous rules or lighter player actions or more indirect conflict, the difference between the first and last player is a little lighter than a game where a player does a whole lot on their turn that could affect multiple people in pretty important ways.
Right. And in some games try to have, like, an inverse player balancing where the last player to go has some benefit that the first player to go doesn't.
Mm-hmm. This probably usually happens more in games with more direct player competition, where it's important to see what the other players have done, so that you don't have to predict what they do. You just know, and you can put yourself in a very advantageous position against them.
Right. But so these are all kind of, like, looking at individual game mechanics and how they relate to player count in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I want to look more at sort of what player counts mean as far as how the games in general can flow.
Okay.
So two-player games, I think, are interesting because you see a lot of competitive two-player games, especially two-player games that are designed to be competitive first, especially like abstract games. A lot of them take inspiration from games that are played competitively, like chess and Go. Even if they're not designed with, like, a tournament structure, they still have that sort of aspect. And then there are games that are designed to be played in tournaments, like card games and stuff. But I think part of the reason why you see this with two-player games so much is because you only have two players to keep track of. So, like, strategy-wise, you can think of your own strategy, and then you only have to think about what your opponent's doing. If you have more players, that's more strategies you have to consider. And so, like, managing hidden information or reading what the opponent's trying to do, stuff like that's a lot easier in these cases when you only have two players.
Right. You could just think of it like the amount of other player strategies you have to keep in mind doubles when you go from two to three.
Right.
But when you go from three to four, it doesn't double. It's less. And everyone, therefore, is a less of an addition, you know, compared to what you were dealing with.
Right. With three-player games also, there's, like, this really awkward dynamic that games have to sort of position themselves around.
Mm-hmm.
Where if each player... So this is sort of a tempo thing. If each player is equal in, like, their abilities, and you impact another player negatively, attacking them. So not always, like, directly attacking them to hurt them, but just, like, you know, negatively impacting their strategy in some way. If you have to go out of your way to do that, then that means that there's a third player left that's ahead. Also, if two players attack one person, then that person that gets attacked is behind the other two.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of that as like resources spent versus resources taken away from the opponent. In two-player games, it's a lot easier to do this because there's only two players. And so every time somebody attacks, it's only the attacker and the defender. But as you add more players, you either want to make the cost and the loss a little lessened, or you want to make it so that you can hurt multiple people at once, which is why indirect conflict is so prominent in games that are 4 and 5 player. Because that way it's like you're not just spending resources to attack somebody and then everybody else at the table is unaffected.
Mm-hmm. You know, this makes me curious to see what a game would look like that is specifically designed to be played with only 3 players in a competitive sort of context.
So there are 3-player games that use asymmetry. So, like, they'll have a third player who has a different power than the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're kind of balancing between the person who's directly similar to you and the person who is not at all similar. Or you could just have 3 players that act that operate on completely different axes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you can kind of balance the power dynamic a bit differently that way. But that sort of, like, change in tempo is pretty important to consider. Also because with 2-player games, if there's a tempo loss for one person and a gain for the other, that can lead to a shorter game. But with 3 players, it doesn't necessarily because of the third player. Right. They can change the tempo and balance back away from the person who gained it. And so there wasn't as much of a shift in like who's ahead, who's behind.
Mm-hmm.
And for every player you add in that case, it can also change that as well. So you kind of have to think of, like, is the game state being significantly altered? But also, with fewer players, it's easier to accept things like snowballing or something like that. Because it's only 2 people playing the game, they can just restart it if they want.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, with more players, if somebody is, like, way far ahead, then you have more people who feel like they just didn't get to play the game, or like it's harder to restart these games for each player in those cases.
Yeah, in this case, you probably want to design some sort of catch-up mechanic or some sort of balancing mechanic,
right,
so that there's still a chance for a majority of players, or just make a game that doesn't have such massive tempo swings for just one player.
Right, or games that like score at the end of the game,
sure.
So it's harder to feel like you're wasting your time. Yeah, or just make it. Or just make a game that has a quicker setup.
Right. Okay. What I was going to ask is, why does 4 players always seem like a good number for any game?
4 is even.
As long as it's not designed to be specifically a 2-player competitive game, 4 players always seems like a good number.
So, yeah, 4 is even. That's a thing. If you do have direct attacks, you can have 2 sort of separate attacking pairs. So, like, if I attack you and then player C attacks player D, then you have 2 players that are ahead that can compete with each other and 2 players that are behind that can catch up again.
Mm-hmm. It's also sort of taking into that point you made with 3 players, that if one player attacks another, there's a resource spent there to change the tempo, and the 3rd player is totally unaffected. But in this case, 2 players are totally unaffected, and now they can probably look to each other to start to change that balance again.
Exactly. It's a it encourages more like splitting off into separate squabbles.
Mm-hmm. I think it also makes it feel a little less personal, maybe, or like feel like you're a little less targeted when there's 4, because when it's 3, either it's 2 players ganging up on 1 player, which feels a little bad, or it's sort of like a rock, paper, scissors circular effect, which feels kind of maybe repetitive or inevitable. But with 4 players, it seems like when the power balance shifts, it's never quite as linear, like one to the next to the next to the next. It sort of becomes a little more nebulous, like the way people's attentions are pulled and the way certain people get the lead and lose the lead.
Right. Going back to that, like, first and last turn order sort of balancing structure, if you have four people, it means there's two in the middle, which isn't... I mean, like, it seems kind of arbitrary to distinguish between two players in the middle and three in the middle, but I think it goes back to that, like, players who have resource difference is the second and third player in turn order aren't too different from each other in terms of their position in the game, and so they can compete with each other to try and, you know, put one of them ahead. Or they can compete with the person in first, obviously. And then the last thing I think is that a lot of board games are square, and so you can have, like, one player to each side or one player to each corner.
Yeah, a lot of tables are square.
I think this especially happens with games that have a significant, like, spatial element to it.
Sure.
Is you'll tend to have four players on a board, even with hexagon boards like Tapestry. I think Tapestry is five player, but... even then, like, six players on a hexagon still can be pretty crowded, whereas, like, four players means you have four corners outside of, like, the two pointing out corners. Four obtuse corners, and those obtuse corners are sort of evenly spaced from each other. And so...
This has been geometry.
Yeah. A little bit of trigonometry, if you will. So I think four and five players are pretty similar, but I think five players tend to either be less about, like, heavy decisions, or they tend to be like in much larger boards if there is a spatial element. Because the board of Tapestry is pretty large.
Yeah, as is the board of Scythe.
Yeah.
I think another thing about five players is it's, you know, the average, at least the last I checked, the average family size is two parents with 2.5 children. So five conveniently fits a full standard family, statistically wise.
Yeah.
So five, a player count of five is pretty good for, like, more family-oriented games.
Right.
Do you have anything else?
Not exactly. I think
we talked a lot about upper limits, but is there anything you want to say about, like, lower limits of games?
Right. I don't know. I think so. Like, for example, Seven Wonders struck me when I first played it, how it doesn't have a two-player mode, really. It just has three players. But that's more because of how it works with, like, the neighbor dynamics, that it's kind of awkward to have two players because there isn't an entire neighbor.
Sure. I mean, look at the difference between Seven Wonders and Seven Wonders Duel. Like, they kind of had to redesign a lot of aspects of that game for it to be more of a two-player, more enjoyable as two players. Like, they could have just kind of copied and pasted the game, made slight adjustments, but they kind of redesigned the whole thing.
Yeah. I think there are games I've seen that have, like, specific two-player modes because they want to have, like, a more directly competitive two-player mode. A lot of them kind of do add in extra mechanics or change things around to make it fit. But I think it's interesting. Like, having fewer players makes it easier to play the game, just because you don't have to have as many players in one spot. Just a scheduling thing. And so I can kind of admire when games have, like, high player counts, but they have a pretty low limit for, like, I can just bust this out when I'm bored at home. And if I have, like, one family member, we can play it. I think when games want to add a solo mode, I feel like it works really well in games that have, like, victory points, I guess, because you can kind of have a score attack element. And then obviously there's the automata stuff, which is cool, and I like that it's being explored more, but, like, that's also a lot of components you have to add.
Right.
But I think a way that helps having lower player counts and like still work is if the outcome of your actions is pretty easy to understand. This is like, it helps you when there's more players because you can plan around like what you need to do much quicker. But with fewer players, it lets you take into consideration what your opponent's trying to do much better. I feel like Res Arcana is a really good two-player game because of this. That like the resource management and your actions are all very simple, so you're able to kind of look at what your opponent's building and what they're trying to go for, even if it'll take a few turns for them to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting that in games with maybe like partial player interaction, the fewer players you have, the more they're going to interact with one another because there's less, you know, people to look at, to aim your guns at or what have you. So that's an interesting idea. Like it may be, if you don't want players to be interacting too much with one another, that could be a reason to set a high lower end.
Yeah.
And that's something to just keep in mind. Like if there's fewer players, then they're going to be interacting with one another more frequently because they're not interacting with other players.
Right. The other thing to consider is like the atmosphere of the game and the tone you want. So like Betrayal doesn't really work with two players because you'll have one survivor and one imposter, or sorry, one betrayer, traitor, getting a little hung up on Among Us. But like that's also a game where kind of the idea is that a bigger group is going into a house and one of them betrays the rest. That sort of tone is a lot harder to do with just two people. I mean, it would be different, but it would also be different. Or like, you know, a lot of take that games that try to be really rowdy, you know, things like Munchkin for a bad example. They would be really different for fewer players because it's less take that and more of just, you know, standard conflict and aggression.
Right.
Whereas like the point of them is more that when you have enough players, it becomes really frantic and hectic and like just a slugfest, you know. Red Dragon Inn as well is one where, you know, slugfest, get it? But it's one where, like, having more players means that there is not just more, like, player interaction going on, but there's a lot more stuff happening, I guess. Like, in Red Dragon Inn, you know, people give each other drinks, there's more literal take that cards, there's more gambling rounds started. And so, like, the real depth of the game doesn't show up when there's only a few players. And so you kind of have to think, like, is the main game that I'm trying to sell to people visible at low player counts? If not, then you might not want to balance around those.
If you're designing a game and you're trying to figure out what the ideal player count is, playtest the different player counts. You know, I'm sure there's some of it that you can picture, like, obviously I don't want this to be a two-player game. This game is at least meant to be played among three players because there's plenty of space to grow and indirect competition to have, and I don't want things to get too direct. Or maybe there's just so much room that two players is just not enough to get people to start bumping into one another. Playtesting with various player counts will let you know, like, whether you need to add more spaces in like a worker placement game or add more cards to a deck because you keep running through the deck too quickly, and whether those things need to be modular so that at more players the game is balanced for them, or whether they don't have to be modular. Like maybe the game plays just fine between two and five players, and the number of players will just sort of slightly change the way that it feels to play the game.
Right, you can't design a game in your head, so design the game with people if you're trying to make a game for people.
Right.
That means, just try it out.
And something interesting to just look into is check out your favorite game on BoardGameGeek.com because they have polls where players can vote on what they think the ideal number of players for a game is.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of funny that, like, obviously it's actually kind of interesting that lots of games have variable player counts, like 2 to 5 players, 3 to 4 players, you know, etc. Because of that, it's interesting to see what people believe to be the ideal number. Right. It's just like a weird quirk about video about board games.
That like, yeah, that people play them enough that they kind of have their preferred player count, yeah. Even despite having so many different player counts available.
It's kind of actually just dawning on me kind of how interesting that it's just assumed that every game, every board game you play has a lower and upper end for how many players can play it. Like, right. That's kind of weird that
that's why I wanted to do this episode.
Many board games for just one specific number of players other than two.
Yeah. Or one.
Hmm.
Or seven. Wait. Seven. Okay. Yeah. I think that's about it for me.
Okay. Yep. That's about it for me too. So with that, that concludes our discussion on player counts. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. We didn't even do midway plugs.
Yeah, we didn't. I mean, there wasn't really much of a, you know, break naturally right. in the discussion. Anyways, if you like, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast. Hit us up with feedback, suggestions, comments, just to say hello. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, to find our websites where we catalog and tag them. So if you're looking for an episode on a specific game, you can search the tags for that game, and that'll take you straight to the episodes where we discuss it. You can also find a link to our TeePublic store there. That's tpublic.com/user/bgbcast. We appreciate it. If anyone feels that our merch is cool enough to wear in real life, I personally believe that it is, and I wear it every day. That's a lie. I wear it some days. Yeah, that does it for BG Bros plugs. Let's hear for Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and sometimes Thursday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3:30 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I stream a lot of strategy games, roguelites, multiplayer games, some platform fighters. I stream Fortune Street every Friday, which is a really wild digital board game. And that's been a really fun adventure while also making me pull out my hair. So come check that out if you want some fun talk on just games, or, you know, I talk about design and stuff like that as well on there. I make YouTube videos on youtube.com/IEatSonic. It's an older username of mine, don't mind me. I've been reviewing/analyzing the video game The Witness, and I've also been working on a review/analysis of Sonic Adventure, which will be coming out in a week or two. Also on the Board Game Bros website, I sometimes do like blog post reviews, which I have one coming out soon about the video game As Far as the Eye, because I didn't want to make a video on it, but I did want to talk about it. It's pretty cool if you like board games.
So be on the lookout for all of that.
I also have a Discord you can find through my Twitch page, where you can talk to us, talk to other fans of our work, get updates on when I go live. I also post on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming. I tweet about whatever's on my mind, as well as when I go live on Twitch.
Right. I also stream occasionally at twitch.tv/radicalhawks. twitch.tv/radicalhawkz, and you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs.
Oh,
thank you for listening to our
episode. I forgot. I also have a new podcast coming out with a friend of mine that guested on our show once.
Yes.
Keep an eye out for that. Not quite enough to announce yet, but follow me on Twitter for more updates on that.
Yes, be on the lookout for that notification as well. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next episode where we will discuss a board game?
Maybe.
Maybe.
See ya.
See ya.